This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The 2014 gubernatorial election is now a year away, and Tom Foley, while still not officially a candidate, is taking on Dan Malloy by buying some airtime in New York City. Yes, he's appealing to city-dwelling conservatives who think liberal Connecticut wouldn't be the best escape from rampant de Blasioism.
But wait a second. Connecticut next year will probably elect a new governor. When it does, Connecticut once again will be the place people want to be in the Northeast.
Confused? Yeah, us too. And the controversial head honcho in Bridgeport's school system is on the ticket for the Illinois governor's race?
Second fiddle, third fiddle, second banana, fifth banana, green bananas. Doesn't make any difference to me.
Green bananas. We'll hear from a reporter in Chicago on Paul Vallis bailing on Bridgeport for a run at the number two job in Illinois. Those are among the topics we will tackle today on The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. You can join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266 is the phone number to call. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at wherewelive as well. Colin McEnroe is here, as always. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello again, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
And joining us from our New Haven studios today is Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, before we get to some of these local issues, we're going to start with the big global news of the week. Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines. Marine Brigadier General Paul Kennedy flew over one of the metropolitan areas hit by this typhoon. He described the scene on NPR's Morning Edition yesterday.
The area is, as you would expect, with 200-mile-an-hour winds and a 25-foot tidal surge, looks like a bomb went off.
For the third year in a row, the Philippines has been hit by a storm with more than 1,000 casualties. NPR's Anthony Kuhn is on the ground there. He spoke with local officials and debriefed with NPR today.
Well, I've been talking to some of them today, and a police chief told me that they have a curfew in effect. They've got the looting that was taking place before under control. City officials seem to be expressing frustration that things are going so slowly. They feel they don't have the resources and the manpower. And what I'm seeing at the moment is that people who want to use anything just have to ship it in from Manila or from overseas. Things like fuel, there's just a very basic and severe lack of resources here.
So that's the news on the ground. Right now, we're going to check in with Christopher Marnell, who's a senior at Yale, and he's past co-president of Kasama, the Filipino club at the university. Christopher, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
The first important question, is your family okay?
Yes, my family is okay. My family is actually from Cebu. They're in the main city that's just about an hour away from some of the most hard-hit areas. It's actually one of the main staging grounds for a lot of the relief efforts right now. A lot of the different charities like Doctors Without Borders are flying in there. AmeriCares is flying a lot of their people in through there. But thankfully, I've heard from all the family, and they're all okay.
What have you been hearing from them and from others that you know? What are they telling you about what they see around them?
Well, from what I've heard from them, it's a really, really tough situation on the ground. There's widespread looting of a lot of the different resources. There's just not enough stuff there, and so it's really important people start to, you know, donate to a lot of these charities because they're really low in resources.
Could you just describe for people, and we've been hearing an awful lot over the course of the last few days about the topography of the area, about these small islands very, very close together. Maybe you could describe the area of the Philippines where your family's from.
Right. So the Central Visayas, which is really where my family's from, is fairly small, close together, mountainous islands. So really a big problem in some of these places is landslides. The actual distance from the shore to a lot of the mainland communities because of that is not very far. A lot of these people are very close to the shore, and they have to live very close to the shore. So actually when that storm surge did hit, it claimed a lot more lives than it might have if there were slightly, I guess, lower-lying islands.
Now, this is the third year in a row where the Philippines has been hit by a major storm that's killed 1,000 people. Do you feel like the Philippines has become better prepared, or is it just getting battered by this happening over and over again?
Well, I know one of the things is that in terms of some other areas that have been hit by storms in the past, for instance, if you think back to the tsunami over in Thailand, they're a bit more prepared because they're so used to this thing happening. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they necessarily have all the things to deal with a tragedy this big. But they do have some of the resources. They were very prepared in terms of sending the different Philippine Red Cross to the area. A lot of the staging grounds were already set. for a very quick response, but right now it's just kind of hard to get everything going on the ground.
We're talking with Christopher Marnell, who's a senior at Yale and past co-president of Kasama, the Filipino club on campus, talking about his family and what he's heard from the Philippines. It's The Wheelhouse, and we're tackling some of the news of the week here on Where We Live. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. There is a fairly large Filipino community in Connecticut. Have you been in touch with others locally?
So we've been in touch with some of the other schools as well as some of the people in New Haven. We've been in touch with the University of Connecticut program, their Filipino community. We've coordinated with actually a lot of the other schools, too, Quinnipiac. But as of now, we're sort of getting the word out. We'll be putting on an event fairly soon, and so we're inviting everyone in the Philippine community in Connecticut to attend that, too.
What do you know about the relief efforts that are going there right now, Christopher? When we hear about, you know, the United States pledging a couple million dollars in order to put aid on the ground there, do you expect that more will be coming? Do you know anything about the relief efforts that are coming from the United States to the Philippines right now?
Well, right now, I think the United States is doing a great job of putting a lot of the really important things. Obviously, the needs right now are clean water, medication, because right now the hospitals are pretty much empty in terms of supplies. Aside from that, those are really the most important needs, food. And what the United States has been very helpful with is bringing a lot of the security forces to help give a lot of the aid, because right now there's actually widespread looting with a lot of the relief organizations, and so it's very hard to actually get things that you need to the right people. I know just yesterday there were about 8 people who were trampled trying to get some rice.
Kalila Brown, Dean, I just want to bring you in quickly because it seems as though over the course of the last few years we have seen not just globally but also in the United States a series of these very high-profile, very damaging storms. It's just a year from Sandy and, of course, a few years ago something happened in Katrina that we never thought would happen, essentially an American city going underwater, and now we see the Philippines being battered time and time again. Do you think any of these extreme weather patterns speak to potentially America and other countries getting together and taking climate change a little bit more seriously once again?
I think now is the time for us to stop seeing climate change as a political issue and to see it as a public safety concern. So whether we're talking about Haiti, we're talking about New Orleans, the Gulf Coast, we're talking about Connecticut, these storms are coming. They're more powerful. And we have to really put policies in place to address them and to figure out how we can keep people safe and how we can prepare for these storms.
Christopher Marnell, do you agree?
Yeah, I definitely do agree. I think I just remember that the Philippine official to one of the big climate change conferences really gave an impassioned defense of why we need to do something about this now rather than later, because it really is a public safety issue at this point. There are lives at stake.
Christopher Marnell is a senior at Yale University. Thank you so much. And Christopher, we'll be checking back in with you. Best of luck, and I hope everything's okay with your folks and everyone back home.
Thank you so much.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankoski. It's The Wheelhouse. Every Wednesday, we tackle the news of the week. Joining us from our New Haven studios today is Kalila Brown-Dean, who's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Colin McEnroe, as always, joins us from The Colin McEnroe Show, talking about the big global issue of this week. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. But we're going to turn to some state politics, including something that caught our interest. I don't know, Tucker, do you have a little bit of Tom Foley for us? Can we listen?
Hey, New York City. With your new mayor, I know many of you are thinking about leaving. Connecticut, with the same progressive policies you're about to see in your city, may not be first on your mind. But wait a second. Connecticut next year will probably elect a new governor. When it does, Connecticut once again will be the place people want to be in the Northeast. So enjoy one more year in your city, and then come join us in Connecticut under new leadership heading in a better direction.
I am Tom Foley, and I approve this message.
That's Tom. I'm sorry to laugh. That's Tom Foley, who's not running for governor just yet. He's still considering this run for governor against Dan Malloy. That election is about 1 year away. Colin, he took out a very small ad buy. He said it's I think his quote was, it's about as small a buy as you can make and actually still make a buy. But it was targeted at New York City. I know there's a lot you want to say about this. Go ahead.
I could talk for an hour about this ad, actually. There's so many interesting things about it. And it does a little bit have the feel of a prank more than anything else. It does seem, the more you watch it, and I've probably watched it too many times now, it almost seems like something a couple of guys, you know, maybe Foley and his media guys sitting around the bar at the country club kind of cooked up and thought, hey, this would be kind of funny if we ran an ad in New York saying this very complicated thing. And it's even tonally very complicated in the sense that the one thing we can't show you is that it begins with a shot of the New York Post with a big headline saying back in the USSR. So there's this, I mean, you just heard that rather, you know, pleasant new age guitar music in the background, but it begins with this kind of jarring image and one to which I don't think a lot of people in Connecticut subscribe. I mean, it begins with the notion that the de Blasio era in New York is going to be the imposition of, you know, neo-Stalinism or something. And I don't think even that's kind of the mood of the moment. I think most people are kind of, you know, relatively hopeful that New York will enjoy Mayor de Blasio and it's a new wind blowing. And, of course, he won by a landslide. And then, yeah, there's a kind of neural – stop waiting when I'm going on.
No, this is good.
There's a kind of neuro-linguistics to campaign commercials, you know. And you need to be pretty simple. You know, you've got these guys like Frank Luntz and George Lakoff on each side who really started to speak to this. You can't really tell people really complicated things that require a certain cognitive zigzag. You know, usually you say, there's a bear, it might kill you unless I stop it. Or, I am a great guy, it's morning in America, I have two golden retrievers. You know, it's sort of, if it gets much more complicated than that, the average person can't understand it. So what you have here is this commercial saying, wow, you just elected this weird mayor and you're not going to be that happy, so you could come to Connecticut, except, oh no, you can't come to Connecticut because really it's the same progressive policies here. But wait, maybe in a year or so there'll be a different person running Connecticut. And at this point, it's hard to tell who the intended recipient of this commercial is. Certainly not the people in New York. I'm sure it's something that he hopes, you know, will become viral, and, you know, he's kind of right. We're talking about it right now.
The recipient of this is actually us. Yeah. We find it remarkably funny. So, Kalilah, what do you think?
I think it is a brilliant tool. The fact that people are now talking about Tom Foley beyond Connecticut, so it's made national headlines. So for better or worse, he's gotten his name out there. He is now making people stop and talk about it, which in this day and age of social media is what you want, to go viral. But I think the bigger question is, what does it say about the democracy that we love, that we have this sort of Chicken Little, the sky is falling approach? Your candidate didn't win, so you should develop an exit strategy, as opposed to figuring out what you can do in the interim to make your city better and to maybe put forth a better candidate in the next election.
You know, he made national headlines actually a couple of weeks ago when former Speaker of the House Tom Foley died and they accidentally put pictures of him splashed across headlines. I mean, Colin, in some ways, this is a little bit of an interesting move. It's brilliant in the sense that, yes, if we're talking about it, if anybody shares it. But when you talk about the neurolinguistics, I was pulling apart all the different word choices, and including, Colin, this idea that you should enjoy this next year in New York under this oppressive regime, and then you should come to Connecticut, but only if Connecticut elects a new governor. It is one of those spaces where, and I think I will ask Tom Foley this next time I talk to him, if you're either the governor or you want to be the governor, one thing you probably shouldn't say is, stay away from here. This place sucks, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because there's the old adage that's in national politics, that politics stops at the water's edge. And there's, you can sort of apply that here, too. I mean, what he's really saying is, don't come here now.
Right.
Which, you know, if you are somebody who believes in Connecticut and supports Connecticut, if your message is, don't come here until I'm governor, there's a certain implied disloyalty in that. I would also say that sort of enjoy your city. It's not exactly the point that he's making, but this is a guy who already has a few little marks against him that suggests an undercurrent occasionally of, dare I say it, villainy. I mean, he just got through this whole thing where he chased somebody else's car many, many years ago and rammed it a whole bunch of times. And, you know, you don't want to do this kind of General Zod kind of thing, you know, enjoy your city while you can. You know, just, I wouldn't go there right now, anyway.
Kalilah, what do you think about that?
Well, from an economic development strategy, this is certainly not the message that you want to put out to people who are trying to court businesses to come to Connecticut or to stay in Connecticut. It certainly does not help our tourist industry to say, stay away until maybe I kind of sort of maybe might decide to run. So I think that's a misstep. But I saw that video and thought, what is his staff saying? Who endorsed this and who's saying, no, how will this be used against us in 2014? So I think Foley now needs to restate his loyalty to the Nutmeg State.
Well, and one thing that I think we've talked about a bit in the newsroom is we're not exactly sure who is talking to Tom Foley right now and how he's running this campaign, which isn't quite yet a campaign. I'm going to bring in just a second Kevin Rennie, who's a political columnist for the Hartford Courant, to get his take on this, a whole strategy. But before I do, Kalila, something else that sort of struck me about this, it's this appropriation of the term progressive in a way that I haven't really heard from conservatives previously. Liberal is the opposite of conservative, right? Mm-hmm. In the way we've developed language of politics over the course of the last couple decades. Liberal is bad if you're conservative. Conservative is bad if you're liberal. This word progressive, which Foley uses in here, is something that's a little different. We know what it means. We think that it means something left of the left-leaning party. Mm-hmm. But in a general campaign ad, the word progressive might be confused. What do you think about that word choice?
Well, I think it's a poor word choice, particularly if we look at the efforts of the Republican Party across the country to really reunite the party and put forth this more unified front. If you look at the returns in New Jersey and Virginia with that election, this is what you see. So to say that things like education reform or marriage equality or the legalization of medical marijuana in Connecticut is progressive and therefore bad, it means that it's out of state with what other states have done. So Connecticut is not progressive in a bad term, and I think that Foley will have to really address how do you bring voters to the table without demonizing them with this pejorative label of progressive, which before has never been used in that way.
Well, and I think Kalila sort of is making my point much better than I am, Colin. I'm trying to get at this idea, this root word progressive. Connecticut is a progressive place. I mean, overwhelmingly, it seems the Republicans in this state support things like gay marriage. Is it just the wrong term to be rolling out in a political campaign right now?
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, I think we all agree that word choices were not, you know, nobody was Flaubert about this ad. I mean, people didn't really sit down and go over fly-spec every word and try to figure out what exactly it means. But I think Kalila's point is great, and her earlier point about handlers is great, in the sense that Tom Foley is essentially rolling out a campaign without apparently really having done the kind of research that candidates typically do. He actually may be a great candidate. I sort of put quotes around that word, but he might be a great candidate for reasons that we don't, and I don't think he currently understands. In other words, if he can make taxes a really effective issue, he might, even though I find him alarming in other ways, he might actually be a really good candidate, but he doesn't seem to know that yet. And yes, no one will ever mistake Dan Malloy for Paul Wellstone. So, I mean, at the level of progressive politics as we understand them, I wouldn't think that would be the way to go after him.
If you want to join our conversation about the 2014 gubernatorial race, yes, we're already talking about it, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can also email your thoughts, wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. Let me bring in Kevin Rennie, political columnist for the Hartford Courant. There's a lot to talk to Kevin about, but I'd like to get your take on this Tom Foley ad, which I'm sure you've seen, Kevin. Is it a brilliant political strategy? Is it just a goof? What do you think?
I think brilliant political strategy and Tom Foley will never be mentioned in the same sentence again. Let's just talk about his use of the word progressive, which I view, I think, differently than your guess, and that is that, on the left, they would never say conservative Republican. They would only say Tea Party Republican, no matter who it is. And I think on the right, to use the word progressive is paying a courtesy that is never returned. I think he should have said the left-wing madness of Bill de Blasio that's going to drive people out of New York with higher taxes and higher crime. That was the point I think he was trying to make, but somehow boiled it down to just calling them progressive policies. I frankly think the word progressive has been terribly misused in its appropriation by the left, but that's just me.
So far in this Tom Foley non-campaign, Kevin, we've seen him throw out a series of allegations, some of which were clearly things that were out there in the news. Some of them were things that he alleged, but they didn't have anything to back up. And then he had to backtrack off of that. And then we see him entering into the fray in this other odd way, taking time in New York City to run this very confusing, maybe funny ad. Just give us a little sense of how you think the first couple months of the Tom Foley for Governor 2014 campaign's gone.
Catastrophic. And I think he is providing plenty of time for Republicans to absorb him as a cautionary tale that if they want to win a year from now, their best chance is absolutely not with Tom Foley, that they really hobble their party and their chances if they decide to nominate Tom Foley. He's just proving himself, even after running a campaign in 2010 that he almost won, he's showing himself to be just stunningly inept as a candidate. And I think one reason for that is that he doesn't listen to anyone. I don't think he seeks much advice. The advice that he does seek is solely for the purpose of confirming what he's already thinking.
You know, Kevin, it's Colin. I think all of us, first of all, when you talk to Malloy people, when they are candid with you, they will tell you that they would much rather run against Tom Foley than against John McKinney or maybe just about anybody else. On the other hand, you sort of look at how this might play out. And you know, we both know, Kevin, from the conventions we've been at in the last couple of cycles, that Republicans do show a little bit of a preference for guys who can write their own checks or for people who can write their own checks. And that's part of the appeal of Foley. I think we probably assume that he might even come out the winner of a convention, then go into a primary season with McKinney and whoever else, Boughton or whoever else might be in the field. And then it gets kind of complicated. You know, For people like us, I think John McKinney seems like a really appealing candidate. He has, you know, a slightly scholarly manner to him. He's smart. He knows the issues reasonably well. He takes positions that I find, even progressive that I am, that I find palatable in many ways, even more palatable than many of the things that the Malloy administration says and does. So to us, he looks like a great candidate. I'm not exactly sure, and Kevin, I'd be interested to know what you think, how all this plays out in front of Republican primary voters whose psyches I don't pretend to understand.
Something to remember is that Tom Foley eked out a victory at the Republican state convention against two pretty weak candidates. And then in the primary, 3 months later, he barely won. You know, that was a very late primary night because he only won by a few thousand votes against Mike Fedeli. Because Mike Fedeli, for I think 2.5 weeks at the end of the campaign, finally had some money. So I just think that a decently financed candidate, which if either Mark Boughton or John McKinney meet the $250,000 threshold, they'll have enough money to challenge Tom Foley in a significant way. So I think that a primary would be different this time. And I do think that Mark Boughton and John McKinney are much different candidates than Mike Fedeli mm-hmm. and Oz Griebel were. They're better known. I think they're better liked. And I think each one has a more natural and bigger base of support.
Kalila, do you agree if the Republicans end up with one of these other candidates as opposed to Tom Foley, a much better chance to beat Dan Malloy in 2014?
Well, I think we have to also look at the changing demographics of the state. And when you think about the increased numbers of Latino voters in the state and voters who have sort of split their loyalty between Republicans and Democrats, it gives Republicans a better shot. But the real question is, will this be a vote for the Republican candidate or will it be a vote against the governor? And whatever candidate emerges can really use that to their advantage. So I don't think it's a lock for Foley, but I think that Republicans, if they can overcome that initial hurdle of fundraising, could make a very effective play for the governor's title.
We're talking with Kalila Brown Dean, who's an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. She's in our New Haven studios today. Joining me here in Hartford is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. And stay with us for a few minutes, Kevin Rennie, political columnist for the Hartford Current, because when we come back, we want to talk about your column about private email accounts in the Malloy administration. If you have thoughts about the 2014 gubernatorial election already, 860-275-7266. It's The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our political news roundtable, and we're talking with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on your show today, Colin?
We have pigeons. Where we are doing a salute to pigeons, ranging from... There actually has been a doping scandal in the world of pigeon racing.
In the world of pigeon racing,
in
really?
The world of pigeon racing. Seriously, there has been a doping scandal, so we'll be exploring that, as well as sort of general things that you might want to know about pigeons, and then at the end, exploring the literary significance of pigeons, including Pigeons on the Grass, alas, the famous Gertrude Stein line, which may have been uttered for the first time ever in Hartford.
Really? Mm. Will you be doing the pigeon call more often during the show?
Possibly.
Okay, possibly. Colin McEnroe this afternoon at 1 o'clock. We're also joined in our New Haven studios today by Kalila Brown Dean, who's Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. I guess I'm kind of glad I couldn't see your face while Colin was doing that impersonation just now, Kalila. I want to turn, though, to Kevin Rennie, who's political columnist for the Hartford Current. In your column this week, Kevin, you took on the Malloy administration and their usage of private email accounts to do the state's business. Talk a little bit more about this, because it seems like the sort of thing that a lot of people would assume that government does to get around trying to make things available through public information.
Well, I think you're probably right that people do assume that it is done. I didn't realize it was being done on such a vast scale in the Malloy administration. I filed an FOI, Freedom of Information request, for emails for two members of the governor's staff, and I limited it to the topic of his education proposal in 2012. And I was surprised at the number of emails that resulted eventually from that, about 6 months later, from that request. And what I saw was that virtually everyone who was communicating on the bill through email was sending emails from a Gmail or other private account, and to people who were receiving them, staff members and others in the administration who were receiving them in other Gmail or Yahoo or Comcast accounts. And in the past, when someone had done something like that, you could usually find that maybe one or two of the addresses were private addresses and the rest were state email account from a state email account. But this wasn't the case. This was clearly a seriously developed shadow private network of emails that looked to me that the sole purpose was to keep it out of the state email system. And I now believe, particularly since the emails that have been coming into my to me since my column appeared on Sunday, that a lot this has been going on in a pretty prolific way, and the governor's office refuses to say what they do to preserve these emails, not only now but when officials leave the administration. So for instance, his governor's legal counsel Andrew McDonald used a Gmail account for some public business. And he's left the administration to go to the state Supreme Court. It seems no one has done anything to preserve those public documents that he created as a member of the governor's staff. The same thing is true of Rory Occhiogrosso, who was his senior advisor. He also had a very prolific Gmail account. He's gone, and it seems as if no one's done anything to preserve those emails that are public documents and that need to find their way into public preservation.
Colin, and just so that our listeners who don't follow this stuff as closely as we do, certainly as closely as Kevin Rennie does, understand, We were talking about emails between government officials on government email address trying to do the public's business. Those are things that should be publicly available to us. We can make a Freedom of Information request. It's something we often do to sort of see where ideas come from, where conversations happen over email. This is something that's, I don't think, necessarily widely known by the public, but it's certainly something that journalists have known for a very long time. Colin, what do you see in all this?
Oh, I see a lot of things. I thought it was a great column, first of all. And it's obviously this practice isn't new. It was quite a scandal in the Bush years. If you may recall, they actually set up an entire shadow email network. I think it was financed by the Republican National Committee on like a GWB08 something or other. They could do all their stuff on these private email accounts. What's disappointing about the Malloy administration, and it's kind of an odd parallel to the Obama administration, is they both kind of went in making some proclamations about how they were going to be the most transparent administrations of their type ever, that they were going to set new levels for this, and they just haven't done it. I mean, this Kevin's story is a part of a larger network of stories about an administration that is uncooperative and isn't eager to comply with FOI law, that doesn't seem to like the FOI law very much at all. And I think an important part of Kevin's column, too, is one thing that sort of is hard for people to understand is the rule basically is if it starts on the tree of a publicly maintained email account and then the apple migrates somewhere else, you can follow that apple onto private email accounts. Now, the problem is, and Kevin pointed this out, is that now you're depending on somebody basically screening their own email accounts and saying, okay, you can have this one, this one, this one. You can't really look at the whole email account very easily and say, oh, wait a minute.
That's an important point. If you make a request of emails from the state system, the Department of Administrative Services has those in a vast that they preserve them on. So they're not going to disappear. And there is a way for the at least their existence will be acknowledged in by a independent party. That is not someone who's part of the governor's office or a commissioner. You know, it's part of the civil service. So you can feel more confident that you're actually getting everything that was created. When they say, "Well, we let the people whose emails you FOI'd decide which ones to turn over," That causes some uncertainty as to exactly what we've got.
Well, and Kevin, I'll play a little devil's advocate here, and I'll say, you know, we have long heard that the folks in the Malloy administration, driven by their governor, who is a very hard-charging guy, work an awful lot of hours, and they spend an awful lot of time thinking about their work in government. It's not so, frankly, unusual for me to switch back and forth between my Gmail account and my WNPR account when I'm sending work emails to people at 9 o'clock at night about something that's on the wheelhouse tomorrow. Do you think that this may very well just be a case of people mixing business and pleasure accounts in a way that almost all of us do? Or do you think that there's absolutely something more to it?
I don't. No. I read many, many pages of emails, and the fact that almost all of them were outside the state system in terms of how they were generated and to whom they were sent suggests that would not be the case. If, for instance, the person, if that were true of just the person sending them, I could understand that. But there's no reason why they would be sending them to anything other than the person, the recipient, the state account. So I thought about that, but the manner in which this whole thing was executed suggests that is not true. You are kinder than I am, which I freely admit, so you're nice to bring up that possibility.
Well, Kalilah Brown-Dean, I mean, what do you see in all this? As Colin's talking about, this maybe not just showing up in the Malloy administration, but in the Obama administration as well. This idea that transparency in government is something that you talk about, but sometimes you don't necessarily follow through with. You see this being a lack of transparency coming from the top in state government or even in the federal government at the executive level?
I think it's a practice that is not unique to this administration or really to the state. I think that increasingly, as technology changes, as the public's demand for information increases, this is occurring. But it's important for Connecticut because we're a state that has adopted very strict ethics guidelines. And if we want transparency and accountability to be key features of our government, then we have to address this problem. How can you maintain the public's trust if it seems like this is being done outside of the boundaries of public information? And I think it's an issue that we're going to have to address at the top, but also it raises the question of if this is happening at the level of the governor, what's happening at the local level as well? And how might those on-the-ground issues that affect our daily lives also be beyond the bounds of what we have access to?
You know, this is also not restricted to the executive branch either. And Kevin, I don't know whether you know, you may know more about this than I do. I do remember I was on a panel with Rob Simmons not long ago, and he and the Yankee Policy Institute are saying that legislative emails are purged at an alarming rate. I can't remember the
legislature system by design is meant to to shut the public out.
Yeah, they purge their emails really fast. It's very hard to get their emails.
Yes, and that's how they want it.
Yeah, Kevin Rennie is a.
And I say that as someone who I once tried to get some emails that went back quite a way, and I was told that it would cost $10,000 to do the research. By no means am I saying that the Malloy administration invented this problem. They have taken it, I think, to a new and different level in Connecticut. Under the Rell administration, the chief of staff, Lisa Moody, would double delete her emails. That means she'd delete them on the day that she got them, and then quickly delete the delete box, so that when the system would try to preserve them, as it existed at the time, would try to preserve them overnight, which is how they did it then, they wouldn't be there. You can't do that now, as I understand it. That once it's in your inner sandbox or draft, it's saved by an upgraded state system. At the time, they just tried something different, and that was the thing that would allow us to find it out. Though was that not everybody in the state system who was sending emails to Lisa Moody would do the same thing. So you could kind of figure out how to at least get the sent or the received ones, and then you'd see, gee, there's not its opposite number in coming in her email account. So you knew it had been double deleted.
Which is why, Kevin, whenever I ever got an email from Lisa Moody, I never knew it was going to be anything that was too interesting or newsworthy. But there you have it.
Worth saving just for historical.
Oh, absolutely. I think I still have them. Kevin Rennie is a political columnist for the Hartford Courant. You can read more about this in his last Sunday's column in the Courant. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation, talk more about the Malloy administration as well, including Dan Malloy being not so terribly happy with the pace of this investigation into the Newtown shootings of last year. You can join us 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up in tomorrow's show, last week, Illinois Congressman Luis Gutierrez stopped by Real Artways in Hartford to talk about his life, his relationship with President Obama, and his vision for comprehensive immigration reform. We'll hear some highlights tomorrow from my interview with him and talk about his new book called Still Dreaming, My Journey from the Barrio to Capitol Hill. I hope you can join us on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today is The Wheelhouse. It's our weekly news roundtable, and we're joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and Kalila Brown-Dean, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. In just a few minutes, we'll be turning to Chicago politics, of all things, and how it relates to Bridgeport, Connecticut. But first, Governor Malloy just announced the other day an additional 435 schools across the state are receiving state funding to improve school security in the wake of Newtown.
With these additional funds, a total of $21 million has now been allocated this year to making our schools safer in the state of Connecticut.
But an awful lot of what the governor talked about was how we still don't have a police report from last year's school shooting at Sandy Hook.
This has gone on longer than any of us would have liked, and certainly is not representative of how I would have handled the timing of this report. It needs to get out. It needs to get out this week, next week. It needs to get out.
So the governor, Colin, clearly getting a little bit peeved at the pace of this. And I think talking about this at this event where he was, when he's rolling out some money to help security at schools, I think a lot of people are looking at this saying, you know, I'd really like to know more about what happened last year before we start spending money on how to secure our schools.
This is you can sort of take this and apply this to our previous conversation in the following way. And I'd love to hear what Kalila has to say about this, too. But there are a lot of reasons to have open and transparent government. One of them is sort of crowdsourcing. It means that anybody, an academic like Kalila or just a citizen, can look at what you're doing and say, well, look, I see something that you could do better. I see something that you're missing here. In other words, the more that people know about how government operates, they can play roles as citizens in order to help it operate better and ask intelligent questions about it. That's one reason to have open government. Another reason to have open government is that when people are doing bad things, we have a better opportunity to catch them at it. And the third reason is to create confidence in government, a sense that government's operating the way that it's supposed to, because we live in a healthier society where people feel like they know what's going on and feel like they have a certain level of confidence about it. You know, all of those things, I think, are coming into play here with the Newtown Report, not just the Newtown Report, but the multiple track cases involving freedom of information around Newtown, ranging from the public hearings that are being had right now about the homicide photos to the case that's being had right now about the 9/11 calls, plus this report. First of all, you create an environment where people have less and less confidence that they're being told everything that they need to know. Yes, so that they can make helpful suggestions about school security, and also, yes, so they have confidence that they know the story and that government has done, government in all of its manifestations, ranging from police departments to investigators to legislators to policymakers, has done the things that they're supposed to do. And I would just say, Governor Mueller is too late in announcing that the report is too late. We're almost at a one-year anniversary. I think for most of us, this is absurd.
We are almost at a one-year anniversary, and when we were told that this report was now going to come out in the fall, I reminded people that, yes, indeed, the fall includes December 14th. Nobody wants to have that happen. Kalila, what do you think about how long this has taken and how it has maybe compromised some of the processes here? If you see schools trying to prepare for a new school year, if we'd had this report back in June, as we were originally told we would have, maybe you could spend a couple months thinking about how you'd make a more secure school. You certainly would have been passing laws about mental health or guns slightly differently if you had different information, right?
Think about it this way. We are a week away from a major lockdown at Central Connecticut State University. And a lot of people have questioned, was that the appropriate response? It turned out to be a Halloween costume gone wrong. But we didn't know that at the time. And so perhaps law enforcement's response to that event had to do with things that happened at Newtown or things that could have come out in that report about how to respond. We don't know that because we don't have the report. So I agree, if you want the public's trust, you want the support of parents to say, I'm going to send my child to school knowing that the schools are now better prepared. We don't have that information. We don't have that confidence. So we can allot millions of dollars to making schools safer. But how do we know that we're actually prepared to not just prevent those types of events again, but to respond adequately? And that's why the report is key. It's not just about people who want to get the gory details. It's about knowing, do we have the policies in place to support law enforcement? How do we provide services for first responders who face those gruesome scenes and then are expected to do their job in an effective way? That report is critical. It's critical for Governor Malloy to demand it. And I agree, we should not be approaching the one-year anniversary and saying to those families whose lives have been permanently affected by that massacre, this is sort of the payoff a year later. We're now just getting this info out.
And those gruesome and gory details, as you call them, Colin, those are back in the news as well. If perhaps maybe people think the governor's taken too long to get angry about the pace of this report, we're also just now starting to get a little bit more from people like Brendan Sharkey, the Speaker of the House, explaining in an opinion piece why the legislature acted at the 11th hour at the request of the Newtown families to shield from public information crime scene photos, not just from this crime scene, but for all crime scenes in Connecticut, so that they wouldn't come out and then we would have some sort of a comprehensive review over the course of the last year. It seems like just now lawmakers are starting to grapple with what they did several months ago.
Yeah, I mean, that's bad legislative process. You don't pass the law first and then hold public hearings about whether you passed a good law or not. That's a problem. You know, and I thought sort of the tell in Brendan Sharkey's piece was the part at the end where he said, I couldn't look these people in the eye if I hadn't done something like this. And you know, and obviously in pressing for the release of these photos, we in the press are going to be kind of the bad guys. And we just have to kind of absorb that. I'd like to say, I don't want these photos. Mr. Dankosky doesn't want these photos. We're not interested in publishing these photos. We're not interested in looking at these photos. Most people in the press aren't. So why would we engender a whole lot of public antipathy in asking for them? Because, you know, as Jim Smith, who's on the FOI panel, said, it's wrong in a democracy to withhold details of a crime. It's a bad idea. It's bad government to do that. And beyond that, I think that, you know, and once again, I risk sounding like a bad guy, but the truth is, this isn't a new problem. In other words, people, unfortunately, get murdered in this state every year. Lots of people get murdered in this state every year, and some of them are children, and they have parents. Some of them are parents of children who might conceivably have to look at crime scene photos. This became a problem because of the incredibly high profile of the Newtown case and because many of the parents from Newtown, quite understandably, have become activists about it. But Brendan Sharkey right now is responding to a problem that's existed forever. He's responding to it now because there are people kind of in his face about it.
Kalila, quickly.
I agree. I think this is an ongoing issue. We have to think about what we owe victims and their families, but what we owe citizens of this state more broadly, and how do we weigh that against without being painted as the good guy or the bad guy, but the one that supports the democratic principle.
We're talking on The Wheelhouse about the news of the week, and we want to turn to something we normally wouldn't wade into. Yes, Illinois state politics. Last week it was revealed that Governor Pat Quinn tapped Paul Vallis to be his running mate. Yes, it's the same Paul Vallis has been surrounded by controversy as superintendent of Bridgeport Public Schools. Yesterday, Quinn and Vallis made their first public appearance together as running mates.
I'm a public servant, and I gravitate towards taking on the big assignments and the big challenges, and that's something that Pat has done all his life.
So joining us now to talk about Paul Vallis' reemergence in Illinois politics is Linda Lenz, who's publisher and founder of Catalyst Chicago, an independent news journal focusing on urban education. Linda, welcome to our show. Thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be with you.
So this isn't the first time that Vallis has entered statewide politics. He's done this before?
Yes, he did. He ran for the Democratic nomination for governor before, shortly after he left the Chicago Public Schools, and came oh so close to winning it and lost instead to Rod Blagojevich. And I don't know if Connecticut listeners knew about him, but he turned out to be
that.
A disaster and now is in a federal prison.
He had a nice head of hair, I seem to remember. So what did you think when you first heard Paul Vallis was doing this, especially given everything that's happened here in Bridgeport, everything that happened just in the Bridgeport school board election this past week, which a lot of people saw as some sort of referendum against Vallis and against school reformers nationwide?
Yeah, well, I think people will think, well, that's Paul Vallis. I mean, he goes to places that are, in deep water and have contentious politics. He really gravitates to that. And I think that in Illinois, they think of it as, well, that's what Paul does.
Okay, so that's what Paul does. What else can you tell us about him? And given the way that he has polarized people, how popular do you think he'll be right now amongst Democrats in Illinois?
Well, that certainly is a big question. When he was school superintendent here, because of, his personality and bold new reforms, some of them which were ill thought out, he had enemies. But generally, the grassroots people liked him. I mean, Paul, even though he can be explosive, he wants people to like him. So he would give this person that program and this person that program. And while there's, been discussion here about there being an African-American candidate for lieutenant governor, one of the leaders in the African-American community. So, Paul isn't that bad. He really kind of helped our community, when he was in the Chicago Public Schools. But we'll have to see, because one key difference here is that there now is a teachers union that is, strongly opposed to most of the things that Paul Vallis has pushed as, an education professional. Charter schools, using test scores, putting schools on probation. I mean, the teachers union supports Pat Quinn, the governor, but they put out a statement very quickly saying, we need to talk.
Well, and that's really what I was getting at, Linda. We're talking with Linda Lentz from Catalyst Chicago, talking about Paul Vallis now going for the number two job in Illinois and leaving the Bridgeport Public Schools. I mean, he and many of his colleagues in that education reform movement have made absolutely no friends amongst teachers unions. I assume teachers unions are a pretty important voting bloc in Illinois.
They absolutely are. But what's their alternative? They're not going to support any of the Republican candidates, you know.
But will they come out strongly for a Paul Vallis on the ticket?
Well, I don't think they would want to risk losing the governor's seat to a Republican. So they're not going to be enthusiastic, but it's very hard to believe that they'd sit that out. Although, you know, even as I say that, I mean, Karen Lewis, the head of the Chicago Teachers Union, is to some extent a wild card. I mean, it'd be fun to see those two go at it with each other. I mean, maybe it is in her to sit it out, or at least threaten to sit it out and see what she can get out of them, you know, in return.
You know, I have more of a question than an answer here. I would sort of observe, first of all, that this latest development helps me understand the Bridgeport situation a little bit better, and I've been kind of puzzling over it and not quite understanding all the coded language that went on in Bridgeport. But one of the questions, obviously, in Bridgeport was whether Mr. Vallis even had the right paperwork to be a superintendent of schools, whether he was properly certified to be a superintendent of schools. It was a question that he seemed supremely uninterested in most of the time and willing on a nominal basis to take a summer course or whatever it was to get that certification. And I wonder if what we're seeing here are the stresses and strains of the rise of a new class of educational administrators. I mean, superintendents of schools in the past have tended not to run for any office other than president of the National Association of Superintendent of Schools. Whereas, you know, now you have sort of this politically wired guy who can plausibly, apparently, you know, vector suddenly from superintendent of schools of Bridgeport to a lieutenant governor nomination in a different state. It seems like we're talking about a different kind of animal. The closest thing that I can come to recognizing this kind of animal was Evan Dobell, who, when he was president of Trinity, came in with a tremendous amount of political wiring and approached his job as president of a college in a very different way, one which the culture of the college, the academic culture of the college, had trouble identifying with and recognizing because he just really wasn't one of theirs. This stuff wasn't bred in the bone for him. And I'm wondering if that's one of the things that happened in Bridgeport, that the teachers, that the educational community thought, this isn't a superintendent of schools the way we think of a superintendent of schools. This is some other kind of guy.
Linda, any thoughts on that before I let you go?
You know, that does resonate with me, but I do think that, you know, Paul's a bit of an anomaly. I can't think of any other superintendents that have, you know, tried to jump into politics like that. And while there are other superintendents that don't have education backgrounds, that really hasn't swept the country.
Linda Lentz is publisher and founder of Catalyst Chicago. Thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us, Linda. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now, before we leave, we're going to talk a little bit about something we've been talking about a lot here on the show. We just have a few minutes left, Colin, but today there's a hearing at the state capitol on sexual assault policies at the University of Connecticut. From what we understand, the president of the university, Susan Herbst, will not be among those testifying.
Yeah, and then it's sort of difficult to know. It's always difficult to know when the legislature convenes or impanels on this, what they're planning to do or what their real questions are. Although, I mean, I think there are a couple of salient things that are going to come up that are worth looking at. One of them is that whole notification process. So we now know that these four complainants, these four young women from UConn who are complainants, are going to testify before this panel. One of them has a story to tell about having made a rape complaint, having been assured that the alleged assailant had been ushered off campus and was banned from the campus, only to find him sitting next to her at a meal a few weeks later, and she was never notified. That maybe is something that could be redressed or at least addressed legislatively. I think the other thing that's an interesting question, I can't really tell whether the panel's planning to get into this, but I'm a little curious to know a little bit more about what the status of a campus police force really is. In other words, they seem to deal with these things. They seem to be the first resort for dealing with these kinds of complaints. Is it the same thing as taking your complaint to, in the case of Mansfield, I assume you'd have to take it to a resident state trooper, but is it the same thing as taking it to either a state trooper or a municipal police force, or do campus police forces operate under a different set of guidelines and practices? And I honestly don't know the answer to that question, but this whole imbroglio has made me wonder about it.
Kalila, we have about a minute left. You're on another college campus. You've been watching this UConn thing from afar. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
I think that we need to take these allegations seriously. The shame and the stigma that victims of sexual assault feel need to be taken seriously. And to Colin's point, when you have a campus security staff that is generally very familiar with the students there, I think it compromises the students' ability to have faith that their claims will be taken seriously, but to also have that level of objectivity to say, this is serious, we need to remove a threat to the student body.
Yeah, but in that, though, I mean, look, cities have been trying for years to get what's called community policing, actually knowing the cops a little bit better. Mm-hmm. It seems as though the cops know the students pretty well mm-hmm. on the UConn's campus and another campus. Is you're saying that might be a bad thing?
Well, I think it depends on who you're asking. So if you're a victim of a sexual assault, you don't want to feel like your claim is not taken seriously because the security officer says, oh, well, I know the person in question, and that's probably not how he meant that. And so even if that's not what's happening with the UConn police force, security force, if students have that perception, they're not going to come forward.
Kalila Brown-Dean is Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. She joined us today from our New Haven studios. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you very much, Colin.
Thank you, sir.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives. Help today from Betsy Kaplan, Jonathan McNichol, and Laurie Mack. The senior producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. It's The Wheelhouse on Where We Live.